The following Noble Path talk is part of an informal series offered to Sangha members for those who've been practicing at the Zen Center of New York City, Fire Lotus Temple. Each Sangha member shares their experience of how they came to find the Dharma and how their practice has been developing. We hope you enjoy the diversity of voices and experiences. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. As Joshin said, my name is Kian. I am an ordained monastic at Zenmont Monastery, as she said. Hojin Sensei would normally be here giving a Dharma talk, but she's actually up at the monastery giving an arts retreat, so she asked me to give this Noble Path talk in her place. So a Noble Path talk is where a student who's not a teacher, who's still very much on the path of clarifying this life as we are, shares their personal journey. It's a way for us to connect, to find commonality in this very big endeavor that we're doing, to see that we share our struggles, we share our hopes and joys. So I gave my initial Noble Path talk about 6 months ago, and Shugen Roshi, my teacher, suggested for this talk I talk about faith. So with Hojin Sensei's permission, that's what I'll talk about today. And I'll try to do it from my own personal experience, sharing my struggles on the journey as a student for the last 27 years in this order. I hope there's something in this talk that's of benefit to you. Some of the questions I would like to explore with you are, what is faith in Buddhism? What is the relationship to faith within Zazen practice, within meditation? How is it cultivated? How is it cultivated during times of difficulty, especially when things feel difficult? How do we stay on the cushion, engaging our practice during times of turmoil, such as now? Likewise, how do we continue on this path when things start feeling a little better? How do we not compromise and say to ourselves, I feel a little less suffering, I'll stop now? In essence, how do we practice with a more wholeheartedness, both when our life is going well and when it's not? So let me start by giving some definitions just so that we're talking about the same thing. What do we mean when we speak about faith in Buddhism and Zen? Faith or sometimes trust is also used interchangeably. It's not a blind belief in Buddhism, but it's something that through authentic practice is transformed into direct knowledge and verification. The Buddha said not to blindly believe in anything he says, but to verify it for ourselves if it's true or not. But we need faith to put in the effort in order to be able to see if it's true. So traditionally, when we speak about faith in Buddhism, we're talking about faith in the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Faith in the Buddha means faith in the Buddha's enlightenment, faith that his enlightenment, his deep insight and clarity into the nature of reality and non-separation with all of life is also possible for us. Faith that we have enlightened Buddha nature, that everyone has enlightened Buddha nature, which only needs to be revealed through thoroughly practicing and realizing for ourselves the Dharma that he and other realized beings have laid out. Faith in the Dharma means faith in the Buddha's teaching, which can be succinctly summarized as faith in the Four Noble Truths. Briefly, the Four Noble Truths are: one, that living an unrealized life means that we are suffering. Two, the cause of this suffering is our continual self-grasping desire. Three, that there is a way through practice to release the self-grasping. And four, the Noble Eightfold Path, which is our Dharma practice and study, is the path to release our grasping and to find freedom. Faith in the Dharma could also be expressed as faith in cause and effect, that every moment is the coming together of causes and conditions, that my actions have consequences for good or ill, and those consequences cannot be escaped. Faith in the Sangha means faith in the community of practitioners, particularly faith in our teachers and what they're teaching us. But this faith is not a static thing. It's not something you either have or you don't. Once you have it, it's not always there. Sometimes it feels strong, sometimes it feels weak. Over time, practice, when we practice in an authentic way, it does deepen into wisdom, but this is not linear. As we start to let go of like more surface level things that create suffering for ourselves, it allows space for deeper, harder things to arise. So sometimes it feels like things are getting worse, not better. Because our practice isn't going perhaps the way we expected it to, we can become impatient, fearful that things won't change. We can fall into doubt and maybe even give up on practice. This word doubt can be confusing because it's used in two very different ways in Zen that are opposite each other. The three pillars of Zen traditionally are said to be great faith, great doubt, and great determination. When these are in balance, our practice is going well. Great doubt that is used here is a spiritual doubt in our conditioned life and samsara. It's doubting our dualistic mind and what it's telling us. Doubting the internal law, our internal dialogue or views about the world that we hold. This is a needed doubt to free ourselves from our conditioning. The doubt that's not helpful is the doubt in the Dharma and the teachings that can lead us away from spiritual practice. This doubt is kind of like the opposite of great faith. So in speaking about faith, I'd like to look at a poem by the 12th century Zen master Hong Zhu. In the very first line of this poem, he very succinctly expresses the practice needed to realize oneself. The rest of the poem speaks of what unfolds after that is accomplished. As I read this poem, notice what comes up for you. Does something resonate as this poetry being true? Do you feel like this is speaking to you, that this is something that's actually possible for you? This poem uses the word trust, which can just think of trust as faith that's been verified over time. So Hong Zhu didn't title his poetry, so the offer of this the book Cultivating the Empty Field titled this, With Total Trust, Roam and Play in Samadhi. Empty and desireless, cold and thin, simple and genuine. This is how to strike down and fold up the remaining habits of many lives. When the stains from old habits are exhausted, the original light appears, blazing through your skull, not emitting any other matters. Vast and spacious, like sky and water merging during autumn, like snow and moon having the same color. This field is without boundary, beyond direction, magnificently one entity without edge or seam. Further, when you turn within and drop off everything completely, realization occurs. right at the time of entirely dropping off, deliberation and discussion are 1,000 or 10,000 miles away. Still, no principle is discernible. So what could there be to point to or explain? People with the bottom of the bucket falling out immediately find total trust. So we are told simply to realize mutual response and explore mutual response. Then turn around and enter the world. Roam and play in samadhi. Every detail clearly appears before you. Sound and form, echo and shadow, happen instantly without leaving a trace. The outside and myself do not dominate each other, only because no perceiving of objects comes between us. Only this non-perceiving encloses the empty space of the Dharma realm's majestic 10,000 forms. People with the original face should enact and fully investigate the field without neglecting a single fragment. So I'm going to mostly talk about that first line. I interpret this first line as Zazen instruction. Empty and desireless, cold and thin, simple and genuine. This is how to strike down and fold up the remaining habits. When we sit in Zazen, we settle our mind by remaining still, not acting out of desiring anything other than what is arising in the moment, becoming completely intimate with it. Empty and desireless, cold and thin, simple and genuine. When a thought arises, we see it clearly. We do our best to not react to it. We don't grasp at it. We don't push it away. We don't try to change our experience to try to be more comfortable. All of these strategies are little microwaves to create more restlessness, more karma, more conditioning, more habit energy. Instead, we see the thought clearly, we let it go. We let it in, we let it pass through, maintaining a soft body, a soft heart throughout. Each time we genuinely do this, we're striking down and folding up the karmic habits of many lifetimes. So it certainly takes faith to sit still when unpleasant thoughts, feelings, sensations arise. The more unpleasant the thoughts, feelings, and sensations, the more faith that's needed. The same is true with pleasant thoughts, feelings, sensations. We want to hold on, cling to pleasant experiences to make them last, to make them not go away. How much faith do we need in practice? Without having verified for ourselves that freedom from suffering is possible, how do we trust the medicine we are offered to be still and not turn away when something uncomfortable arises? Hongzhi's poem says, people with the bottom of the bucket fallen out immediately find total trust. The bottom of the bucket is a poetic way of saying when you've realized yourself. When realization happens, only then total trust occurs. Faith is then totally verified. Self-grasping is an expression of a lack of deep faith or trust in this present moment. So before we have total verification, it makes sense that we're self-grasping, that we don't have total trust, because that's all we know. So how do we have faith in something we haven't realized for ourselves? We don't actually need a whole lot of faith to begin practice. Chogyam Trungpa was asked that question, how much faith do you need? And his response, which I've heard my teachers recently quoting, is maybe 1%. So I'm going to tell a little bit of a story that seems like it's going off on a tangent a little bit, but it relates. In 2021, I took up cold plunging. I didn't plan this. I wasn't aware that cold plunging was becoming a thing during the pandemic. I only knew that I loved swimming in the wilderness, and I didn't want to give it up as the summer was drifting into the fall. There's a beautiful watering hole near the monastery in the woods that I just love going to, and I just didn't want to give it up. Before that year, I'd never gone swimming beyond Labor Day, so I decided in 1 week's time it won't be that much colder, so I'll just try it next week. And at the monastery, we get Mondays off, so we have a training schedule, and then the full Monday is off, so that's the time to go swimming or whatever. So the next Monday I went, and it was definitely colder. But again, I told myself, let's try to go one more week. It'll be a little bit colder. It will only be a little bit colder. So I wondered if I could keep this up into the beginning of October. That was my initial goal. It seemed far-fetched for me at the time because the water was getting pretty cold and I had a lot of resistance. I decided to make a pact with myself. I made a promise that I would go each week and at least take the temperature of the water. Once I did that, I was free to change my mind if I wanted. I would go to the river, take the temperature, and then I'd have a long debate with myself. My mind was screaming, no! It would take me sometimes 30 minutes to gather the courage to actually do it. One time I actually left and walked 15 minutes back to the car and sat there and it's like, do I really want to give up? And finally turned around and came back and did it. So the temperature kept dropping. I made it into October, and then I said, well, I made it this far. I was very proud of myself. Why not see how far I can go? I started noticing how good I felt after I went in. Then at some point, even though it was getting colder and colder, the experience wasn't quite as hard as it was during that initial time. When there'd be this huge resistance, my mind would be screaming, no way, I would start to ask myself, have I ever regretted going into the cold water? The answer was always no. I was noticing how every cell in my body would become alive and dopamine would flood my body. I'd feel a warmth in my body. It'd be kind of exhilarating to be just in my swimsuit in the cold air and not feel cold, walking on snow. I would feel a sharp mental clarity. And even though my body was exhausted from the training week, it would just totally revitalize myself and I'd be ready to go right back into the week of training again. After a mild December, there was a cold, wintry Monday in January. The temperature was in the 20s. It was windy. There was a lot of snow. My commitment to at least take the water temperature was well established, even though I knew the water was going to be 32 degrees. As I was driving along the icy river to my spot, I was asking myself, what the hell am I doing? My mind was screaming its familiar no, but it carried more weight of justification for the stance this time. I was feeling certain I would listen to what my mind was saying and turn around after I took the temperature. But something strange happened. After taking the water temperature, in the midst of my mind doing its thing, my body was doing another thing. My mind was saying no, but my body was saying yes. My mind watched in a state of surprise as my body simply slipped into the water. And as usual, the effects were exhilarating. After having done this for most hosans for the last 3 years, I feel very little resistance, no matter the temperature. I just go right in. The voice of resistance is still there, but it's very quiet. It knows it doesn't have its say in the matter. Now, whenever somebody at the monastery, somebody maybe visiting, finds out that I jump in the freezing water, and then they tell me they would never do that with a certainty that it would not be good for them, I kind of nod my head, and I understand where they're coming from, because 3 years ago I would have had the same exact stance. But at the same time, I know that they do not have the direct experience to understand, nor to have the total trust in its benefits that I have through actually doing it. I began with a tiny bit of faith. Through experience, the faith slowly transitioned into verified trust. I share this story because I think there's a parallel between this and cultivating faith in Zazen. For me, the cultivation of faith or trust has been much, much slower in Zazen than with cold plunging, and it's still very much in process. I think part of the reason for this is that our kleshas, and kleshas is a, you know, I'm going to be using this term a lot, it's a Sanskrit term for our mental defilements, our afflictive emotions. These kleshas go much deeper than we realize when we first start practicing. Our addiction to them runs very deep. The three main afflictive emotions are greed, anger, and ignorance. There's also pride, jealousy, and others. I've been in residency continually for 9 years now, but the total amount of residency has been maybe roughly almost 13 years. So I was thinking about this. I think I've done over 150 week-long sessions at the monastery. And for those who haven't done it, a session is a week of Zen intensive meditation where we sit still in the Zendo for roughly 10 hours, just turning inwards. So there's no distractions, no familiar comforts. We're just facing our mind the whole week. So what I find interesting is that even though I've done all these sessions, I've never once entered into session where I didn't have some resistance to doing it. I always resist giving up what I think are my comfortable habits that I need to hold on to. Lately, I've been noticing a familiar pattern where towards the end of Sesshin, my mind is settled, I have a bit of clarity in seeing what is arising in my thoughts, and I'm not grasping so much. I feel wonderful. I find myself asking during each Sesshin, how did I forget how great Sesshin is? Why in the world would I not want to do this? And I look at myself when I started Sesshin, like, who were you? Why were you resisting? But then after session is over, I eventually fall into my many usual comfortable, comfort-seeking habits, and I forget that very direct experience that I had in session. It becomes a concept that's distant. The kleshas, when we're in our kleshas, they have no idea what the spirit experience of non-grasping is, just like someone who's not cold plunge has no idea the exhilaration that feels. So back to Hongzhi's first line of his poem, his practice instruction. Empty and desireless, cold and thin, simple and genuine. This is how to strike down and fold up the remaining habits. From the stance of within our kleshas, this doesn't sound very appealing, does it? All our kleshas want excitement. They want sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But from deep within our Zazen, when the kleshas are no longer running the show, we can have the direct experience that Hongzhi's instruction is pointing to and see for ourselves that instruction is the very lifeblood of what will make us the most alive, even though from the stance of the kleshas, it seems very not exciting at all. And our kleshas do run very deep. You can tell just by looking at the state of the world right now, it's all klesha. So our Zazen instruction is to see the thought that arises clearly without judgment and let it go. But are we seeing all of our thoughts clearly? It requires us to be empty and desireless, cold and thin, simple and genuine. Otherwise, we are in some subtle way feeding them, getting caught up in grasping and aversion. I remember when I first sat down to meditate in my early 20s for the very first time. Before I did that, I first encountered the Dharma about a year earlier, and I was so excited to find Dharma book in Dharma books answers to life's questions that I never knew I had or never knew that there were answers to. I voraciously read everything I could, but even though I was reading about meditation, I wasn't meditating. I didn't know anything beyond the intellect. It was satisfying my intellect, and I had no relationship with anything beyond that. But then I had to go to the emergency room for a sinus infection. They gave me penicillin. It cleared up, but I soon had the return because it came back. And the same thing happened, and then I had the return a third time. At my third visit, the doctor told me I was inducing my infection through stress. Then suddenly something clicked from what I was reading. Oh, stress, I'm creating it with my mind. Oh. And so I sat down for the first time and faced my mind. What I found was utter chaos. I was shocked. I think with the advantage of a beginner's mind, these chaotic surface thoughts fell away in my very first period of Zazen, and I found peace I had never felt before, and my infection never came back. So I then felt this, what I thought was supreme confidence. I enthusiastically told my friends and family about Buddhism. It's the most wonderful thing. I gave books away, and I was a bit shocked that nobody was excited like I was. They weren't reading them. Why weren't they excited like I was? So even though I had this experience for the next 5 years, I sat on my own. This was before I found a Sangha, and I was very restless. I couldn't sit still. I would only sit for 5, maybe up to 15 minutes, and I would be sitting there, and then there would be a thought about something I should do, and the next thing I knew, I was doing it. I was like, oh, I was supposed to sit Zazen. I just was caught up in my thoughts. So even though I had this faith, it was at a certain level. It wasn't faith and being still with these bigger thoughts and feelings that were occurring. I did not have the faith I needed to sit still when deeper kleshas were arising. And I was unknowingly avoiding them. I was trying to nest in that good initial experience that I originally had, and I had no awareness about how I was sabotaging my lived experience in my subsequent moments. In 2001, after having lived at Zen Monastery for a few years, I was intending to ordain at that time, which I later did many years later, I ended up leaving the monastery, and I really struggled with these deeper kleshas. I had all kinds of strategies to try to make my life comfortable, but also not face my deeper, more painful kleshas that were arising. I convinced myself that whatever I do is Zen, that everything is practice, and I tried unsuccessfully to find comfort in that. So I would continually try to soothe myself, not facing my discomforts, and tell myself that I was practicing that fourth candy bar or that sixth Netflix movie in a row. And then around 2006, I remember being in Doksan with my original teacher, Daito Roshi, and I was just sobbing. My life wasn't working out the way it was supposed to. Daito told me very plainly that I was between a rock and a hard place, and he didn't offer anything to fix me. And it really felt like that. I knew too much to go back, and I didn't seem to have the courage to go forward or the willingness. And that lasted for a long time until I slowly, very slowly, began to start facing this deep pain that I was carrying, from which the kleshas were trying to shield me from. Not all thoughts are easy to let go of. Different thoughts have different karmic weight. Repeated thoughts that we say to ourselves over many years or that society says to us carry a heavier weight and can become strong views, opinions, and identities that we may feel so strongly that we could even feel like we would die for. These are not so easy to see into because we think they're not a thought, they're me. We are fused with them. So last Thursday was Juneteenth. It was the 100th year since the ending of slavery, which we did a dedication during liturgy. And even though slavery legally ended 160 years ago, our nation had generated hundreds of years of greed, anger, and ignorance around the perception and interpretation of skin color, and the greed of taking advantage of others for personal gain through that identity. This karma of this deep, that is deep within our culture and our conditioning, is not so easy to let go of. At Zen Mountain Monastery, students are collectively doing what we call Beyond Fear of Differences work to focus our attention on the unconscious biases we have inherited and are reinforced societally based upon gender, race, sexuality, etc. Our teachers have recognized that this type of work is not personal karma, it's collective societal, so it takes collective effort to do this. We're working to undo our biases so that we can truly see and appreciate one another. But it's not easy at the deepest level. Not all thoughts carry the same weight. If our experience is not that of Hongzhi's poem, then we are operating in the kleshas. It's important to recognize and acknowledge that. There's no need to judge ourselves for it. We're all in the same boat. The Buddha said that the two most important things a student can have are good spiritual friends and self-honesty. We have to clearly see our suffering before we can change it. It is important that we become familiar with our kleshas and how they arise, how they operate in our particular mind and body. To see the thought, the klesha clearly, it requires us to make direct contact with our suffering. Rebecca Lee is a Chan teacher who studied with Master Shen Yin. She recently led a retreat a few weeks ago at the monastery called Silent Illumination, which is a term that the author of this poem, Zen Master Hongzhi, coined. She wrote a wonderful book by the same title where she lays out different modes we operate in when we're acting from our kleshas in our unawakened life. I find this helpful to recognize which mode am I currently operating in. I'll give you some of them. Craving mode. In this mode, we cling to pleasant experiences or strive to create them by rejecting and ignoring the present moment. We can tell this mode is in operation when we judge our zazen as being not good by comparing it to a more peaceful meditation that we've experienced in the past. Everything is rising out of causes and conditions. Comparing and wanting just good experiences only afflicts our mind with suffering. Aversion mode. In this mode, we turn something that is happening in the present moment into the enemy, and we set out to remove it from our awareness. We want to have a calm mind, either with no thoughts or only with pleasant ones. Again, this only afflicts our minds with suffering. Trance mode. In this mode, we create a veil between ourselves and the aspects of our mind we don't want to see. This may be one of the most common modes of operation among practitioners. We are frightened by the idea of looking under the hood and seeing what is really going on within our mind. Instead, we learn unconsciously or consciously to dull our awareness in order to achieve some kind of calmness, some idea of calmness, which feels more secure to us than clearly seeing the pain and messiness of our lives. This does not, however, lead to any transformation of our lives. Problem-solving mode. In this mode, we compulsively pick apart the present moment as something that needs to be fixed. When a thought arises, instead of just seeing it and letting it go, we turn it into a problem, even though it's perfectly normal to have thoughts. Intellectualization mode. This is an entrenched habit of substituting concepts for direct experience. When asked how their meditation is going, practitioners operating in this mode often say something like, "My practice is going well. I have come to see that thoughts are just empty and impermanent." This is just substituting Dharma combat concepts for the direct experience of the actual thoughts and feelings that are arising. I think I operated in this mode for many years. The concept of everything I do is Zen was really based on fear of not wanting to really face my life. All of these modes are familiar to me in my practice. For many years, some of them were operating totally unrecognized by me. I kind of wish I had been more honest and saw them. But when they are recognized, we're clearly seeing. We're having faith in the present moment. We can return to allowing the kleshas to pass through us without responding to them conditionally. For most of us, the path has lots of twists and curves, probably all of us. We need patience and gentleness. I hope this talk isn't sounding harsh. We do need to be gentle with ourselves. But at the same time, we need to be firm. Time swiftly passes by. Opportunity is lost. We don't want to squander our opportunities to live a more full life. Just like I've never regretted jumping into cold water, no matter how cold it was, I've never regretted the times I've turned the light around and directly faced the pain behind my karmic afflictions. That doesn't make it totally easier, but it's a little bit more faith as I continue. I'm sure the same is true for you. Daido Roshi used to often say, "Trust yourself." I think this is so, so important. Trust yourself. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.